Welcome to The Green Urbanist, a podcast for urbanists fighting climate change. I'm Ross. Hello and everyone, welcome back to The Green Urbanist. This is part two of the Primal City series, where I'm looking at applying what we know about hunter-gatherers, human evolution, and our prehistory to urban design and planning, or at least attempting to the best way I can. If you haven't listened to part one, I suggest you go back and listen to that. It will be the episode just before this one. In that episode, I really just set the baseline of, you know, what are the basic things that we know about hunter-gatherers and why I think this is important that we understand this and in a sense try to emulate it. And also the fact that we can't really escape our ancestry and where we come from, because we still have the same basic physiology and psychology as our hunter-gatherer ancestors before the agricultural revolution 10,000 years ago. Now, what I want to get into in this episode is how do we start, what does that actually mean for urban design, architecture, planning, the built environment? You know, we're living in a way that is so disjointed, so different from how we evolved to live and how we spent most of our history living. So how do we actually, is it actually possible to live in a way that's concordant with our evolutionary past? I want to draw on a book here by Gustav Mein called Uncivilized Genes, which actually really concerns itself with this question of applying evolutionary thinking and prehistory to town planning. In it, Gustav Mein writes, "Although town life is superficially the very antithesis of the hunter-gatherer's world, this urban paradox can be at least partially resolved. A solution lies in the adoption of proxy behaviours, environments and townscapes that mimic key elements of the nutrition, daily activity, social interaction and engagement with the natural world that our minds and bodies demand, consciously, subconsciously or unconsciously. Positive attributes of this shared evolutionary past need to be developed while negative elements must be constrained." End quote. In the book, Gustav Mein puts forward a range of urban design principles for designing towns and cities in, to use his words, a way that is evolutionary concordant. What is interesting and heartening is that his recommendations align very well with current urban design best practice. That also makes them, in a sense, slightly disappointing, because you might feel that, you know, there must be some secret that we need to unlock. But I'll read through some of what he says and then give my thoughts. So what he calls the urban design protocol is essentially things like provide fresh water, sound sanitation systems, ensure good air quality, put human locomotion at the heart of transport policy and street design, develop an integrated public transport system, develop designated cycle and pedestrian routeways, maintain or extend urban green space, talks more about allotments, community gardens, promote sport, develop more programs of street greening, promote the development of roof gardens, etc. He also says, encourage street-based neighborhoods rather than enclosed estates, ensure residential buildings have adequate natural light, ensure all residential units have access to some outside space. For me, this is useful as it reinforces what good urbanists are promoting anyway. Although this list is not surprising, it is amazing how many of the recommendations are still not realized in cities, for instance, around air quality. However, I do feel like it does not go far enough. If all we needed to live in tune with how we evolved was medium density neighborhoods with local parks and some traffic calming, then many parts of London and other European cities would already be havens of human health and happiness. And the author spends a good deal of the book proving that this is not the case. So we need to go deeper. I want to talk about how the hunter-gatherer social structure could influence urban design, and in particular, our residential design and how we live and our homes. It's fair to say that the main organizing unit of modern cities is the nuclear family. A man, a woman, 2.4 kids, and maybe a pet. The family household is the building block of much of our urban design. particularly the suburbs, where parents and children live together in single buildings, separated and isolated from other family units. This social structure seems so normal to us now, and yet you really don't have to go back that far in history to see that it is a dramatically new way of organizing ourselves, with serious consequences for our lifestyle, identity, and well-being. So how did hunter-gatherers organize themselves socially? Well, here's the summary version. Typical bands of hunter-gatherers are usually no bigger than 150 people, the so-called Dunbar's number, named after the scientist who discovered this phenomenon. When you get more than 150 people, it starts to become impossible to maintain personal relationships with all of them, as anyone who lives in a town or a city knows. These groups were nomadic and lived in temporary camps. Because of the need to be light-footed, there was no such thing as private property, no such thing as my house and your house, and certainly no boundaries or fences. Everything is shared, including food and childcare. There's an old saying that it takes a village to raise a child, and this is a consistent feature of forager groups. Far from being the sole duty of the mother and father, as is generally the case in modern society, it is common for even non-related adults in the group to help looking after and teaching children. The whole community is involved with growing the next generation, and this takes a lot of pressure off individual parents and is also beneficial for children as they get to build relationships and learn from a wider range of other children and adults. In the book Civilized to Death, Christopher Ryan writes, "In an egalitarian band, a child benefits from communal support and love of many adults. In such groups, it's customary for any nearby juvenile or adult to pick up a fussy child. To take the F.A. of the conga as an example, and a representative one at that, anthropologist Melvin Connor has shown individuals other than the mother account for over 40% of physical contact with the baby at 3 weeks of age and 60% at 18 weeks. He found that each infant was taken care of by between 5 to 24 different people." End quote. Ryan writes extensively in his book about the benefits to children of this level of care and social interaction, which I won't go into now to avoid derailing the conversation a bit. But I'm sure many parents listening would concur with the idea of having so many capable and trusted community members constantly on hand to help with the little ones. This ethos of sharing is also true with food. Much of a forager's daily life is concerned with gathering, preparing, and eating food, which must be done as part of a group. We still see this ancient need in modern life in the form of ceremonial feasts, dinner parties, and the traditional Sunday dinner. This not only ensures that everyone gets fed and therefore has an equal chance of survival, but is also a really important social time with clear benefits for mental health and a sense of community. These two fundamental features of hunter-gatherer life, sharing childcare and possessions, particularly food, is getting harder and harder in modern cities as we insulate ourselves in separate homes and replace communal sharing with commercial activity in the form of nannies, daycare, fast food, and grocery delivery services. So there's an argument that recreating the experience of a close-knit forager community based on the principles of equality and sharing should be a far more natural way of living and therefore in tune with our innate biological and psychological needs. And sharing resources is of course inherently sustainable, and if done on a large enough scale, should help us on our journey to reducing resource and energy use. So what would this kind of community look like? Well, luckily for us, there are many examples. Although their connection to our evolutionary past is not often made explicit. The umbrella term for these groups is intentional communities, and they offer some inspiration for how we might live in a way that is concordant with our evolution. Historical examples of intentional communities tended to be religious, like monasteries and ashrams. Others were meant to be utopian, removing themselves, at least partly, from general society. And even others focused on particular political beliefs like socialism or lifestyle choices like vegetarianism and self-sufficiency. For this discussion, I'm interested in intentional communities that are urban, non-political, non-religious, and are largely integrated with wider society, or entirely integrated with wider society, actually, because this seems like a model to me that is most easily replicated. Perhaps the most well-known form of intentional community is co-housing, which originated in Denmark in the 1970s. Co-housing schemes typically involve a number of individual homes centered around shared facilities like a communal open space, food growing areas, and sometimes a communal kitchen and dining area. This allows for the right mix of private and personal space. People can retreat into their private homes as needed, but also have the option of engaging in community life. A lot of socializing in co-housing communities is organized around food, just like our pre-agricultural ancestors. It is common to have a shared dining area where each household commits to cooking a meal for everyone once a month, for instance. In return, they get several free meals every week, which they can choose to attend or not. Co-housing schemes often also share possessions like, for instance, shared tools or a library of things, and will often include a shared guest house that residents can book when they have friends or family visiting. This reduces the need for every household to have extra space and bulky or expensive consumer products, which contributes to reducing energy and resource use. A key element of evolutionary concordant co-housing is that it is intergenerational, with young adults, families, and elderly people living together. This creates a wonderful synergy where older adults can find purpose in assisting with the childcare, and younger adults can help seniors with practical tasks and even just combating loneliness. There are around 7,000 co-housing schemes in Denmark and many more around the world, and there is a huge unmet demand for more, particularly from the elderly. The Academy of Urbanism reports that 80,000 seniors in Denmark alone are interested in moving into a co-housing development, but there just isn't enough for all of them. The very first co-housing scheme from the early 1970s is called Sayetedammen. I'm definitely pronouncing that wrong, but just bear with me. It's located in a small town about 50 kilometers north of Copenhagen. Many of the original residents still live there, and their only complaint at this point is that because so few people want to leave the community, the demographic has become older, and they have less families than they used to. The houses have also risen in value compared to the local area, meaning young families can be priced out. Clearly, this place is a victim of their own success. Architecturally, Sayetedammen is very interesting. The homes are modular by design, and their internal layouts can be modified to match the lifestyle and preference of the household. A blog post on cohabitas.com describes how this works for one resident called Jacob. Jacob's own home is both spacious and light, the original building design modified to include an inner courtyard / atrium room. He explains how the children's bedrooms and lounges have been moved around over the years as the needs of the family have changed. Jacob and his wife now have their bedroom off the lounge with a view of the garden and use of the wood-burning stove in winter. End quote. This focus on adaptability and modularity is another clear sustainability credential. These homes will likely last the test of time as they are flexible enough to avoid becoming obsolete and redeveloped, which is always carbon and resource intensive. Co-housing schemes come in all shapes and sizes. Some are suburban and low density, but they can also work successfully in more intense urban contexts. Let's look at a more urban, higher density version. In the city of Leeds in the north of England is LILAC, which is an acronym for Low Impact Living Affordable Community. It is a co-housing scheme of 20 houses built with straw bale using passive principles and solar panels. The community grows food on site and shares resources like tools. LILAC also has a focus on providing permanently affordable homes through a cooperative model. This solves the problem of rising house prices experienced in Sayetedammen. What I like about LILAC is that despite being clearly a different urban form to the surrounding area, it does try to be part of and contribute to the local area. As their website, lilac.coop, reads, LILAC is also part of a flourishing neighbourhood in West Leeds. We want to be a resource for the wider community for events and facilities. The common house is used for local meetings, film nights, meals and gatherings, workshops, and has been used as the local polling station. End quote. These are just two examples of co-housing, but there are many, many others that are worth exploring, which I may do in a future episode. I believe there is a huge untapped market for co-housing under a variety of economic models, including those provided by private developers. I think innately we all want to find our tribe, our community, and we suffer when this is not available to us. But this way of life is unlikely to work for everyone. As Gustav Mein writes, Culturally, most city dwellers will be polytribal. That is, they will belong to several different tribes simultaneously. We can identify with a particular social class, our immediate neighbours, our work colleagues, or wider professional affiliations. We can be supporters of a football team, usually just one, and have a shared national identity, faith, or political creed. All these groupings serve as tribes, and our behaviour and persona may actually differ depending on which of these tribes we are with at any one time. And it is in this polytribal phenomenon, a relatively modern cultural adaptation, that lies at the heart of successful or unsuccessful urban living with its necessarily complex social interactions. End quote. So co-housing won't be for all of us, and there is a role for the slightly more anonymous individual homes that proliferate in our cities, particularly for people who are a bit more transient and don't want to settle down into a physical community. But I like to imagine a future where we actually have a choice between anonymity and an intentional community, because I know many people would choose the latter. There is one final nut to crack on this topic, though. New build co-housing developments are great where space is available. But what about areas that are already built out? Surely demolishing perfectly good housing to replace them with co-housing is not sustainable. Therefore, we need to consider how we can retrofit existing neighbourhoods to have some of the aspects of co-housing and intentional communities with minimal embodied energy. I want to give two very different examples here. The first is an eco-village in northern Italy called Torre Superiore. In this example, Torre Superiore is a literal medieval village. It has existed for 700 years and is a grouping of compact stone buildings set amongst beautiful hills. In the last couple of decades, it has been totally abandoned, until a group of people came together with the idea of forming an intentional community and began slowly buying up the village. Here they have brought a failing place back to life, preserving its built heritage and creating a sustainable way of life. It's occupied by about 20 people who run the village by consensus and grow some of their own food using permaculture principles. During the summer, they support themselves with tourism by offering rooms, training, and cultural events. I love this example because it could be a model for many other villages across Italy and other countries that are emptying as people move from rural areas into cities. The prospect of moving as an individual to one of these abandoned villages is not very attractive, and clearly market forces have not been able to sustain their economies. But if a group of people can come together to form that critical mass that's needed, then these amazing historic places could find a new life and avoid the carbon emissions associated with building new places elsewhere, while these amazing places stay vacant. But eco-villages also exist in urban locations. The Los Angeles eco-village is 5 kilometers north of downtown LA and has been successfully making use of existing buildings in the neighborhood for the past 30 years. Its website describes it like this. The Los Angeles eco-village intentional community consists of approximately 40 folks who have moved to the neighborhood to live more ecologically and more cooperatively. Most of us are demonstrating the process ecologically, economically, and socially that manifests an eco-village. We are raising the quality of community life while lowering our environmental impacts and expanding public awareness about more sustainable urban living. Michael Pollan and Sarah Ichioka write about this eco-village in their book Flourish. The community's 40 residents live in buildings that were upgraded to suit more socially cohesive ways of life, with a lobby that hosts a regular program of activities and a courtyard with an edible garden and outdoor kitchen for shared meals. Within a city with one of the world's highest levels of private car use, Los Angeles eco-village has succeeded in achieving low levels of car ownership and in widening sidewalks to cam traffic on the street adjacent to their main buildings. End quote. What we see in these last two examples is the power of communities to enact significant local climate action, while also living in a way that is concordant with our evolution. As Rob Hopkins puts it, if we wait for governments, it will be too late. If we act as individuals, it will be too little. But if we act as communities, it might be just enough, and it might be in time. It also strikes me that as we're entering an age of greater uncertainty in terms of natural disasters, extreme weather, political and economic instability, maybe even another pandemic, that strong communities will create resilience. having a community of people to count on to look after each other during the tough times ahead may prove to be a potent adaptation to life in the Anthropocene. I think what really strikes me as I did research for this question of, you know, how do we live in our homes in urban places in a way that's concordant with our evolutionary past? What really struck me is that living in a way that is most in tune with our nature is also a way that could be the most sustainable. And that to me is really a message of hope. And I hope we can take inspiration from this and use that to combat the narrative that taking action on climate change means we need to give up things and our lives need to become worse. Actually, if we are smart enough about it, this transition, this adaptation to climate change, taking action on climate change can be the best thing for us. But I'm not done. I'm not done just yet. That's it for this episode, but I have a lot more I want to say about this topic. The next episode will deal with biophilia, which is our innate love of nature, or put another way, how we can design or redesign cities to mimic our natural habitat. And I also want to talk about movement and human locomotion and how the way living in cities has changed the way we move, which is very detrimental to our health. And again, finding that synergy between moving in a way that is the best for our well-being, it also happens to be the best, better for the planet. That's it for now. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you next time.